from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Just 6 days after Ruchan Abwa spoke on a panel that criticized China's treatment of the ethnic minority Uyghurs, her aunt and sister disappeared. Abbas's family assumed they were sent to the re-education camps or internment camps where the Chinese government holds around 1 million Uyghurs in China's Xinjiang region. Abbas is an American citizen and an activist who has campaigned extensively for the rights of Uyghurs in China, who are reportedly subject to religious discrimination, invasive surveillance, torture, and brainwashing. We're going to hear her story and consider the plight of China's Uyghur population. She's joining me here in studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. We also have with us Sigal Samuel, a staff writer at Vox, who has been covering the story, and we welcome you to the program as well. Good morning.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And before we hear Ruchan Abbas's story, let me just get a picture, if I could, from you, Sigal Samuel, what we're talking about. And we're talking about really 1 million people who are held in this indefinite detention. It's a fairly well-known story, but there's a lot to penetrate here and a lot of nuances to it. For the most part, this is in a part of northwest China. It's open air. But we're also talking about high-tech surveillance, and we're talking about political indoctrination. That's perhaps one of the things that is really of greatest concern here. People are being essentially brainwashed from what we know.
That's right. We're seeing a lot of reports and evidence about people in these internment camps being forced to renounce Islam, to criticize their own Islamic beliefs, to criticize their fellow inmates' beliefs, to recite Communist Party propaganda songs for hours and hours each day while doing calisthenics. There are a lot of reports about people being forced to eat pork and drink alcohol, which are forbidden to Muslims. And there are reports of torture and death. And altogether, this paints a very, very worrisome picture.
And it's certainly worrisome to you on a personal level, Ruchan Abbas. I know you're certainly doing a kind of media campaign, being an activist, which probably brought attention to your family. And your aunt and your sister were essentially at first disappeared.
Yes, as you said earlier, 6 days after I spoke at the Hudson Institute, one of the think tanks, my sister and my aunt also, they live about 1,400 kilometers away from each other. They both disappeared that same day. And they both are not one of those regular targets because they are not public figures or they are not religious people or they are not activists, or not, you know, outspoken people.
Just ordinary just people.
Ordinary, law-binding but people.
Your aunt was recently released, though. Is that a fact?
That's what I heard from distant relatives, but I don't have any communication with the entire region for past almost 2 years now.
Just no idea about your sister, then?
No, I have no idea for past 6 months, her whereabouts and her health conditions.
There's been a social media campaign to try to get names released, to try to at least find out who's being held and so forth. Where is this at present? What's the status of it?
We are still doing that. Me Too, Uyghur movement, introduced by one of our activist friend in Finland, Halmarat. We are asking the Chinese government to give information on our family members and loved ones. The media really picked up and paid attention, but the Chinese government is still being muted on that.
Can you talk about the effect on the children? Because there's so many children involved in this, aren't there?
Yes, there are so many people are taken to the camps. We are talking 2 to 3 million, or even according to Senator Tom Cotton mentioned on the February 6th in one of his speeches, several million Uyghurs are being taken to those camps. So the young children are left behind. My in-laws, both my mother-in-law, father-in-law, and my three sister-in-laws, they are all taken to the camps. And the 14 of my nieces and the nephews from age from 3 to 18 years old, we don't know where they are, their whereabouts. We don't know what happened to them. We are afraid that they are taken to state-run orphanages. And also, I know personally several people that they're studying abroad. Their young children left with their grandparents, and those kids are taken from their grandparents' custody to take into state-run orphanages as well.
Ruchan Abbas with us in studio directs a campaign for Uyghurs, and Sigal Samuel is a staff writer at Vox who's been following the story. The story recently that came out, Sigal Samuel, concerned a musician, a Uyghur musician, on a video that was released. That got a lot of people excited because they were feeling that maybe more names would be released, but that has not been the case.
Yeah, unfortunately, that hasn't been the case. But this is an interesting example of, you know, China kind of accidentally opened this can of worms, because they posted this proof of life, you know, so-called proof of life video of this of hate this musician, Uyghur musician, and we're hoping that that would quell rumors of his death and concerns about him, activism on his behalf. In fact, what happened, as Roshan just described, is Uyghur started this social media campaign, which you can find on Twitter if you look up the hashtag #MeTooUyghur. And it was kind of an interesting example of, you know, on the one hand, we have China using very high-tech methods of surveillance and internment systems to repress a vulnerable minority. But, you know, tech is dual use. You can also have Uyghur activists and others, journalists and advocates in the diaspora, who are using simpler forms of tech, like social media, to fight back against what China is doing. And I've also reported in the past about how web sleuths, journalists, activists are using pretty simple methods of tech to actually pull the veil back on China's internment system, including scholars who are using the Wayback Machine to find digitally archived evidence, you know, Chinese government documents that show evidence of what they're doing with these camps. They're archiving them on the internet before China can scrub them. There's also folks who are using Google satellite imagery to see, you know, physical evidence of the camps and pinpoint their exact locations. So it's kind of an interesting thing to watch how, even as China is using these very high-tech methods of repression, tech can also be used to counter that.
Well, the Chinese government has also reportedly been intruding on U.S. soil, have they not?
That's right. And there is evidence of, you know, China spying on Uyghurs here in the U.S., including, you know, one person who's been very prominent advocate on this about this cause, Tahir Amin, a Uyghur academic here in the U.S., says he's been subject to that kind of surveillance, and he's here on U.S. soil in the Washington, D.C. area. So it's, you know, it's something that Americans should be concerned about, you know, A, because it's just a very frightening, you know, kind of human rights abuse, and B, because it's not limited to something happening thousands of miles away in China. It extends to our, you know, our country right here.
Yeah, there were, and also, I mean, when you talk about human rights abuses, there were reports of forced DNA tests and physical as well as mental torture, and one has to ask about there's been, you know, some lashing back from the United States, from different quarters here in the United States, thanks to the work of activists like Roshan Abbas, who's here with us in studio. The reality is, with the possible exception of Turkey, because a lot of the Turkish Muslims have been a part of this rounding up for the internment camps, there hasn't been much response from the Muslim countries, has there, Ms. Abbas?
Unfortunately, no. I think because of the trade deals and the also United Nations, the China is the second largest donor to United Nations. A lot of Chinese influence to those countries. A lot of Muslim countries have not been coming forward and saying anything.
But the United States has been, I mean, segments here in the United States have certainly been on board. You've had support here, haven't you?
Yes, thanks to the lawmakers. There is currently a Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act 2019. We really need the support.
Menendez and Rubio, I mean, it's bipartisan, yeah.
Yes, it's bipartisan, and it's being supported bipartisan people. We are really hoping that there will be more countries follow that lead in Europe and in the Muslim countries, because this is not just the Uyghur issue or human rights issue anymore. This is a crime against humanity. The entire nation of the Uyghurs being treated as, according to Chinese Ambassador Cui a couple months ago, he said they are using those camps, those re-education centers, to make Uyghur people become normal persons. So they are treating Uyghurs as abnormal people because of their religion, because of their history, their culture and the language.
And trying essentially to indoctrinate them, to change them, and change them not only away from their religion, but make them into a kind of, I guess, Chinese mold, for lack of a better way to describe it. We're also talking about evidence that these camps are growing in size. Many of them are outdoors, and also a good deal of evidence of forced labor. I want to get you, our listeners, involved. I know many of you have been following this story, and many of you may have questions who have not been or are following it. And if you would like to join us, let me invite you to do that now. If you have questions or comments and concerns you want to raise, 866-733-6786 is the number to join us at, and you can do that now. 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We invite and, in fact, certainly welcome your involvement. Here is Olivia, a listener who tweets, tell the guest my household's thoughts are with her and her family. I can't even begin to understand what she is going through and the level of bravery required to do what she continues to do. Hearing that from a lot of well-meaning Americans, I think, aren't you?
Yeah, really, I appreciate that. Thank you.
But it's still, it's torture for you to have to go through this, to not know where your family is, to not know where your loved ones are, to know that they're in a camp somewhere and they're probably going through some kind of mental interrogation and possibly even physical torture too.
Yes, unfortunately, today, this is 2019, the Chinese government is getting away with such atrocity. I am just the one example of millions of families going through this. We have young students. I know personally several Uyghur young girls that's supposed to going to school at the age of 18 and 22, age 20, and they are in New York, Boston, and California, and many other parts of the United States. Because of their parents are in the camps, their financial support is cut, and now they can't pay their education, tuitions. So they are struggling between surviving in the United States and trying to find out what's happening to their loved ones, to their parents.
Let me go back to Sigal Samuel, who is a staff writer at Vox, who's been covering the story. How is China responding to all this criticism, aside from putting out the video I alluded to earlier with the musician, which some have called fake news? Sigal?
So, I mean, over time, what's been interesting is that China has been forced to kind of change tack. And so to some degree, we are seeing the effectiveness of international criticism and journalism, shedding light on this issue, because at first China was very adamantly denying that there were indoctrination camps. They said, we have vocational schools for criminals, that's all. They even tried to depict these camps as really fun resort-like places with ping pong tables and, as if it's something that people should be grateful that they get to go there and have this free education. The more reporters have been digging into this, and groups like Human Rights Watch and politicians like Rubio have been talking about this and bringing this to light. China has gradually had to change tack. We saw them try to retroactively legalize the camps to make it seem as if this is actually a legal thing that they're doing. And we see them kind of scrambling, in response to international condemnation, and the posting of that video of the musician heat was one example of an attempt to kind of deal with that. So we see that public pressure, the silver lining is like public pressure is to some limited degree working, but we need a lot more of it if, China's going to think that it actually needs to stop what it's doing.
Well, let's find out what our listeners are thinking or what they want to ask about this. We're talking about state repression of Uyghurs in China with Roshan Abbas, director of the Campaign for Uyghurs, and Sigal Samuel, who's a staff writer at Vox. And if you'd like to join the program, the number to call, is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Let me go first to Jim. Jim, you're on the air with us. Welcome.
Hi. Can you tell me if this indoctrination system works?
Well, that's a very good question. What do we know about that, Sigal Samuel?
I mean, I think works it depends what we mean by that, right? I mean, I think that many of the Uyghur activists I've spoken to are concerned that not only will this internment camp system not produce the result that China is hoping for, it will not make these Uyghurs more kind of you know, docile, obedient people who support the Communist Party, but it could very well backfire and actually breed a tremendous amount of resistance that, if this goes on long enough, you know, could actually breed a lot of hatred and even violence against the Chinese Communist system. So I think it's very unlikely to work in the way that China would want it to work.
Well, Richard raises a question that I think is appropriate here. One of our listeners, he says, how does this compare to the way China treats Tibetans? It seems that on so many levels, China is a human rights wasteland. I think that's fair to say, but the Tibetans, I don't think, are going through this kind of, call it indoctrination, for lack of a better word. You want to say something here, Roshan Abbas?
Yes, it was a similar the policies, suppressive policies. But back in 2008, when the Chinese government did some sort of re-education for Tibetans, they were mostly like religious scholars, religious figures. Now, the target is entire Uyghur population. My sister, for example, she's a medical doctor. So vocational training centers. She speaks fluent Chinese. She's a medical doctor. What kind of medical, what kind of vocational training that she's going to go through? And the, what's targeted for the Uyghurs are the intellectuals, writers, and the professors, university presidents, university teachers. So basically, the target here is the eliminating the entire Uyghur language, culture, and the erasing, the eradicating the race, basically.
It's all too reminiscent of what was done in many countries to try to make a minority essentially part of what is the majority. And a lot of it, I think, don't you think, is based on Islamophobia, too?
That actually, until 9/11 tragedy in the United States, the Chinese government never had the issue with Islam. They even, just a few months before 9/11, they even released propagandas inviting the foreign investors to come to East Turkestan, come to Xinjiang province to invest, saying this is the safest, richest, the most beautiful a part of the land that you can build and make money here. And then just a couple months later, they used the war on terrorism as a pretext, and they try to suppress Uyghurs. To answer the earlier question, does it work? Well, every time one government tried to take away something that was just a normal part of people's life, people try to resent and do more. When the Uyghur people didn't really care or pay attention after the Great Cultural Revolution about wearing the women covering hairs or men having beards and, you know, just a regular, a simple, a part of like seen as a part of Islam. But then once the Chinese government started to say, don't cover your hair, you can't have beard, then people start to do this more because that's part of their culture. And once the government tried to take that right away, naturally, people try to do something to keep that.
It's an interesting part of human nature, too, often, isn't it? Let me bring some more callers aboard here, and let's go next to Roger in Alameda. Roger, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. I had a question for your guest in terms of the current Trump administration. We all know that Trump has stated that he doesn't really care that much about human rights in other countries, that he's more interested in transactions, doing business with them. Has your guest seen apathy from the Trump administration, resistance, assistance? I'm just curious how she sees this change in our president and his attitude towards human rights in other countries.
Roshan Abbas?
I have personally written to President Trump and the First Lady and the Secretary Pompeo addressing my sister's issue and the plus the more than a million Uyghur people's illegal incarceration. The administration has been very helpful looking into the Global Magnitsky Act sanction for the Chinese officials who's responsible for this horrendous atrocity. And we are very happy with lawmakers at the Congress and the Senate, both sides. So I am hopeful that President Trump is going to include this atrocity when he negotiates with China on the trade and the tariffs and the other issues, because many other countries, they are not independent economically. The Chinese government is loaning a lot of debts that they knowing they can't pay back, try to gain influence to get away with what they are doing today. So United States and the other G20 countries, they should include the human rights issues and the this crime against humanity that Chinese government is conducting toward the Uyghur people when they set their foreign policy, when they deal with Chinese government on the trade and the other issues. The Uyghur people shouldn't become the collateral damage on the world economy and the negotiations.
Well, this administration has not really shown much concern about human rights, often tied, as we saw in Saudi Arabia, with the killing of Khashoggi. Human rights can be put aside if there are pragmatic interests or business interests that play a part of it. But nevertheless, as we alluded to earlier, there is a bipartisan piece of legislation, bipartisan Human Rights Policy Act, that would go against mass incarceration in China of the Uyghur people. Let me thank Roger for his call and go to a question here, if I may, for you, Sigal Samuel, from Christian, who asks, has there been pressure on companies to do business with China, like Apple, to threaten to move their business to other countries that respect human rights?
Yeah, this is actually a very important front line in this story right now, I think. People are particularly focused on Google and the so-called Dragonfly project. Google has been in discussions for a long time about producing a search engine for China that would be censored, so allowing people to do searches, but it would in a censored way. And people are, a lot of Uyghur activists are very concerned about this. The Intercept recently did a story showing that although Google had said it would suspend that project, that might not quite be happening. So there's big concern about companies like that. There's also a lot of concern in light of a New York Times story recently about U.S. companies and scientists' complicity in helping China gather a DNA database based on its Uyghur citizens. So the U.S. company Thermo Fisher was found to be supplying equipment that was being used in the Xinjiang region to aid in the gene sequencing of Uyghurs, which is very frightening. And even a Yale geneticist, his research was being used by China to further their DNA database. So I think American scientists need to not be naive when engaging in research with Chinese scientists about how their research might be used, and American companies need to not be naive. Thermo Fisher said it would stop supplying equipment to the Xinjiang region, but if you supply it to China more broadly, that equipment may very well find its way into the Xinjiang region of China. So I think it really behooves us in the U.S. to be more cognizant of how our research and our products are going to be used there.
Yeah, there's a lot of what Huxley would call Brave New World in all this. I mean, in the surveillance and taking DNA and all the rest of it. I read a comment from Anne who writes, I cannot help but see the plight of the Uyghurs as part of the international community's general blindness to the suffering of Muslims who are being politically persecuted. I'm curious about transnational movements. Are there any transnational alliances among Uyghurs and Rohingya activists? I am very sorry for the suffering of your guest and her family. I am embarrassed by the paralysis of the U.S. What about transnational alliances?
We do.
Comment, Roshan Abbas? Yeah.
Yeah, we do work with all
Rohingya,
Rohingya, and also different faith groups, and we have Christianity and the Jewish community, and going to universities and speaking to the university students and professors, hoping that they will become activists. They will try to help us increasing the raising awareness of this atrocity. This afternoon, I will be speaking at the UC Berkeley, and hopefully more and more people will help us because of this oppression, being controlled so tightly and not being able to obtain passports. We don't have that many Uyghurs living abroad in diaspora, actually. In the whole United States, we only have 5,000-6,000 Uyghurs. So we need more people like this person who wrote, and I appreciate the concern and the thoughtfulness, but we do need help.
Anna's not the only listener who's expressing concern, by the way, you should know. And let me bring another caller on here, and that's Sanjay. Morning. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning. So I have a comment. I think while I'm not a fan of Trump, I think the U.S. policy on human rights have been consistent whenever it has been human rights versus trade interests. Going back to the invasion of Tibet and the genocide against Tibet people, the U.S. has always been silent and consistent because it has got trade interests in China. Okay, so I think there are two issues here. One is that of U.S. being silent on trade negotiations with powerful countries like China, and that is to some degree understandable. But the second one is when U.S. brings in governments that are favorable to the U.S. They so support the bringing in of the Shah of Iran in the 1950s or 60s, bringing in the governments in South America. Those are the things that are more deplorable, okay? But it's been a consistent policy, and I don't think Trump is really doing anything different. I'm not a fan of Trump at all.
All right, I will let your comment stand, and I thank you for it, Sanjay. That's Sanjay, and our next caller is Joshua. Joshua, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. I'm in, you know, same vein as Sanjay. I'm wondering, like, what are the guest's perspective on American consumers' complicitness with Chinese practices with regards to this, with regards to their labor suppression or anything? You know, what is the American citizen's role in, you know?
Joshua, thank you for the question. You got a bad connection, so I'm going to go right to Roshan Abbas, who will address your question. American consumers boycotting Chinese goods and the like? I mean, what do we need? What do we have?
That's what we are calling for. Like Samuel mentioned earlier, Sigal mentioned earlier that the Google and the Apple, Thermo Fisher, and also just boycotting Chinese goods for good. That will be good. We can try to start that kind of activism.
We will have to leave it there. Roshan Abbas is speaking 12:50 today at Bolt Hall, UC Berkeley, and she's director of the Campaign for Uyghurs. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. And we also thank Sigal Samuel, staff writer at Vox. Good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And stay tuned for more on KQED Public Radio. I'm signing off. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.